Welcome. I'm Jim O'Neill, a developer evangelist in Microsoft's Northeast District, with a presentation I delivered in March 2010 as part of our quarterly Northeast Roadshow. Actually, the presentation has been updated a bit since then, given new developments in the Windows Azure Cloud Platform. So even if you attended the presentation at one of our live venues, there may be something new in here for you. Let's get to it. This session is all about data, and specifically the questions that arise when we start discussing the cloud as an option for data storage. Like, where can I put my data? Why would I put it there? And once it's there, what options do I have for accessing it? Answering those three questions is the goal of this screencast. Let's start by looking at the overall data spectrum, now that it appears that cloud computing isn't just a fad. In the Microsoft world, we can start in the upper corner with our cloud storage options. Azure Storage, highly scalable, and SQL Azure, the relational store we're familiar with for most of our on-premises work. The cloud, though, is still a scary proposition. Do we trust our data up there? And what about compliance issues? Many of us are much more comfortable with our on-premises solutions in our own data centers. But does that mean we can't play in the cloud? Not at all. Through WCF Data Services, you'll see how you can have the best of both worlds. Expose your data over the web, but maintain control and ownership of it within the walls of your own data center. As you think about this diagram, though, keep in mind the somewhat oppositional vectors of scale and availability versus compliance and latency as you decide where along this spectrum your own application needs lie. Up first is Windows Azure Storage, which breaks down into the four types you see here, each of which I'll delve into shortly. Across the board, they share a number of characteristics. They are each persistent storage mechanisms, and they exhibit strong consistency, by which I mean each data item is written in three places and not available until that's occurred. That's in contrast to eventual consistency, such as exhibited by Amazon's Simple Storage Service. Your storage options are accessible via open standards, RESTful APIs via HTTP and Atom, and can store up to 100 terabytes of data per account. Transient local storage is also available via the VMs that encapsulate your worker and web roles, but those are really just useful for non-critical data, such as caching. The link shown here is a great deep dive look into how to best leverage these various storage options, beyond just the mechanics of the APIs. The first subset of Windows Azure Storage is blob storage, which, as its name suggests, is for unstructured binary large object data, like documents, images, or video clips. There are two internal formats for blobs, one oriented toward streaming media and another oriented toward random access. Additionally, there are three access mechanisms. Public read exposes your data via an HTTP or HTTPS URL with no additional authentication or authorization requirements. This might be appropriate if you're sharing photos on a Flickr-like site. Shared signature provides the capability to provide limited time access to a selected consumer via a URL. Say you're providing a fee-based model to white papers that you host on your site, and customers can access the documents for 7 days once they've subscribed. Lastly, there's a fully authenticated option that's appropriate for specific applications that need access to storage. On July 1, 2010, the Content Delivery Network, or CDN, option becomes fully available, providing 19 edge servers around the world at which your blob data can be cached to reduce latency for frequently accessed content. I want to take a moment now to step into the Azure portal and see how your storage account is configured, which applies across the board to blobs, queues, and tables. Here you can see that I've logged into my Azure service portal at windows.azure.com, and I currently have an Azure storage account already set up, along with a hosted service. But let's go through the process to create a new storage account anyway. I add a new service, and select storage account. Here I can provide a name and a description. These names and descriptions are internal to the Azure project within the portal, so use whatever makes sense to you. Next, I need to provide a storage account name. That account name becomes the first part of a URL endpoint through which all storage operations are carried out. There's a separate subdomain for blob, queue, and table storage. The account name you select needs to be unique across all of Azure. But for blob storage, you can create a CNAME record with your own domain's registrar to use a URL reflecting your own brand, such as contoso.com. Next, you need to specify what region you'd like your data hosted in. Typically, you want to host your data closest to the majority of your users to minimize latency. In my case, I'll pick the North Central US. Once the service is created, I'm presented with the URL endpoints to access that service. Remember, all service operations are through REST via HTTP verbs like GET, PUT, POST, and DELETE. So these are essentially your connection strings. .NET and other interoperability toolkits for PHP, Java, and so on Provide an abstraction layer on top of this HTTP request response cycle so you don't have to write your data access layer at this very low level, but that's indeed what actually transpires. The access keys are the authentication method for each storage transaction, and two are provided so that you can easily hot swap and periodically regenerate your keys to increase your data security without incurring downtime. Toward the bottom here, you get the option to enable the content delivery network, as I mentioned, as well as map the blob storage endpoint name to URLs in your own domain. This new account doesn't have any data uploaded, so I'm going to use an existing account to show you how you can easily access blob storage. I've uploaded picture data from our old friend the Northwind database, so that by specifying the URL here, I'm able to view the various pictures I've uploaded. Note I'm using the public access mechanism, so I don't need to use the access key associated with the account. And indeed, you should be able to see the same picture via the same URL on your own machine. The URL really has three parts: the endpoint, jimoneal.blob.core.windows.net, the container name, categories, and then the blob name, here simply an ID number. There's only one level of containers, but within a container you can provide any name for a blob, even if it appears to be a multi-level name, such as USA/Massachusetts/Cambridge.jpg. It's a model very similar to Amazon S3, which uses the term buckets instead of containers. Let's move on to tables. Tables provide non-relational structured storage. Again, I'll emphasize non-relational. These are not the tables you know and love from SQL Server. These provide the ability to store typed data, much like a spreadsheet, but there's no schema. One row within a table can vary considerably from another row in that same table. The only common attributes are three columns: a partition key, a row key, and a read-only timestamp. The partition key and row key form the only index available on the table, so the selection of data for these fields is one of the most important choices you'll make when utilizing Azure Tables. And I'll refer you again to the white paper URL I mentioned a few slides back for guidance on this. Tables do provide some transactional consistency, but it's limited to a single partition. As you might expect, there's no concept of joins here either. Azure Table Storage is designed for very highly scalable and high-performance data requirements. It's not something you typically use for the canonical bank fund transfer scenario. There are a number of open source tools on CodePlex.com that you can use to examine table storage, with an experience similar to that of SQL Server Management Studio. But with the June release of the Azure Tools for Visual Studio, you can actually view your table storage right from within Server Explorer. Here you'll note I have a table called Northwind, and within it I've loaded entities from both the Northwind Categories table and the Northwind Employees table. It's important to note that these are really two distinct entity types here, versus one union type with missing or nulled out fields. In practice, you typically enforce a schema on a given table, since it makes using abstraction layers, like Windows Azure's storage client classes, viable, but it's not a requirement to do so. Let's take a brief look at that storage client abstraction layer. This is a small demo application showing how to access data in the scenarios covered by this screencast. The Azure Table option at the bottom uses the storage client classes that are part of the Azure SDK. Now let's take a brief look at the code behind this. Note that it uses the familiar data context paradigm, and you supply the URL endpoint, an account name and storage access key that we saw in the Azure portal. From there, you set up a query, and you can use more complex link type queries as well. The begin execute and dispatcher.invoke code looks a tad complicated, but it's really just implementing an asynchronous retrieval of the data. Especially in cloud environments where latency and response time aren't always predictable, you'll want to use asynchronous versus synchronous data access mechanisms. Again, under the covers, this code will issue HTTP requests, a GET in this case, and using a tool like Fiddler can help you wrap your head around how all this is really working. The third storage type is a queue, which is a well-known construct for most of us. A queue provides reliable message delivery and is typically used to support asynchronous processing in Azure. Within Azure, your application code comprises worker roles and web roles, with web roles generally providing a front-end user interface and worker roles executing some type of business process on data entered via the web roles. Queues bridge the gap. Web roles enter a new work unit on a queue, and whenever there's a free worker role, it can grab the work unit from the queue. Queue items are limited to 8 KB, though, and they have a timeout associated with them. A web or worker role can pull an item off of the queue, but unless it explicitly deletes it, the item will reappear on the queue after a visibility timeout period, which defaults to 30 seconds, but can be as much as 2 hours. What this means, then, is that there's a potential for a queued item to be seen and processed more than once, so you need to take care that your operations on the queued items are idempotent, Namely, that if you process a queued item one time or five times, the end result is the same. Drives are the final mode of Azure storage and actually are just an abstraction over blobs, which is why you don't see them explicitly on the Azure portal. Drives are currently in a beta release, so for now, usage of them incurs only the storage and transaction fees associated with the underlying page blob. Drives provide a durable, mountable NTFS partition, so applications that require file system access can run in Azure without relying solely on the transient storage provided via the VM. Applications can, however, make use of that transient storage for caching in concert with drives to reduce blob transaction costs. APIs are available to create, initialize, and mount drives so that you can interact with them just as you would a local file system. At this point, you may be shaking your head, wondering why this is so complicated. After all, you've been doing fine for years with your DBMS, SQL Server, Oracle, or whatever. Why all the complexity? The simple answer to that is scalability and performance. But the ultimate in scalability and performance may not be a huge requirement for your application, and you simply would like to get some of the benefits of the cloud without completely re-architecting your on-premises applications. That's where SQL Azure comes in. SQL Azure is essentially SQL Server running in the cloud, providing the same relational concepts, stored procedures, and client access mechanisms that you've been using for years with your on-premises databases. There are some differences, though, primarily in the physical aspects of the server. As part of the platform as a service offering, SQL Azure doesn't provide many physical administration capabilities. You can't currently configure backups or file groups. In fact, the server is really just a bunch of configuration files. Databases, though, are nearly identical to what you'd expect in terms of creating tables, stored procedures, triggers, and the like. There are some notable differences, though. First, only SQL Server logins and not Windows authentication are supported. A database is the unit of consistency, so you can't use a use statement or do a cross-database join. You can't use the SQL CLR for stored procedures or triggers, but with the recent June 28th release, you can use SQL CLR-based data types like hierarchy ID, geometry, and geography. In front of the actual server, there are load balancers and a firewall to broker access to your actual database instances. When I first presented this material during the Northeast Roadshow, there were two options available for SQL Azure: a 1 GB web edition and a 10 GB business edition database. With the June 28th update, that changes a bit, and there are two increments for the web edition, up to 5 GB, and 5 increments for the business edition, up to 50 GB. Let's go back to the Azure portal and take a look at provisioning a SQL Azure instance. I already have a server set up with a rather unmemorable server name, and I'm listed as an administrator. The administrator account is similar to SA, but not exactly the same. As you can see, too, my server is located in a specific subregion, here in the North Central U.S. As mentioned before, you need to be cognizant of where your database resides in relation to your Azure applications to minimize latency and bandwidth charges. More specifically, Azure services that reside in the same data center do not incur bandwidth charges when communicating amongst each other. Notice I have two databases set up now, Northwind and Master. Master is a freebie, by the way. Creating a database is pretty simple. All you need to do is select the size you want and give it a name. I won't do that here, though. Note, too, that if you select a database, you can get the connection string information that you might use in client applications. I've used that connection string information already to set up a server configuration in Visual Studio. So let's try to connect from Server Explorer. Notice I was denied connectivity, specifically because my IP was blocked by the firewall. When you set up a SQL Azure instance, you need to specify which IP addresses are allowed to access the server. I can do that via the portal, which in turn modifies a SQL Azure specific table in the master database. And now I can successfully connect. In terms of database administration, you can access SQL Azure via standard protocols like TDS. You can continue to use tools like SQL Server Management Studio, BCP, and SSIS. And a new tool, designated Project Houston, is on the horizon to provide online, web-based administration capabilities. At TechEd 2010, Microsoft also announced the availability of a data sync service via SQLAzureLabs.com, which can aid in syncing across SQL Azure instances. And finally, we've also announced plans to offer some physical database backup capabilities in the coming months. So far, all the options I've been discussing live in the cloud, and that's great for some, but if you have especially sensitive data, are bound by compliance regulations, or simply have an existing investment in capital, perhaps moving your data en masse to a Microsoft data center isn't quite in the cards yet. On the other hand, you'd certainly like to provide more open access to some of that data across your applications, or perhaps to share it with business partners. That's where WCF Data Services come in. You might know it by its previous name, ADO.NET Data Services, or by its code name, Astoria. But regardless of what you call it, it's a framework that can expose data on-premises, or anywhere actually, through open protocols like HTTP, ATOM, and JSON, and via abstractions such as the link-enabled ADO.NET Client Library and a similar framework for AJAX applications. A prototypical WCF data service starts with a data source, perhaps a SQL Server database, on which you build an entity framework model that maps the row-column structure to .NET objects. From there, a veneer provided by system.data.services.dataservices exposes your data through RESTful protocols, making it accessible to any client that speaks HTTP and ATOM or JSON. But you can also build your own class structure, leveraging the iQueryable interface to additionally expose any type of non-relational data that you wish. Let's do a quick run-through of building a WCF data service in Visual Studio. First, since it's a service, we need some type of service host. For this short demo, using an ASP.NET website is a convenient choice. But you could use self-hosting, say a console application, or even the new Windows Server App Fabric, which incorporates what was formerly known as Dublin. The foundation of the WCF data service is the data, of course, and here I'll simply use the old standby Northwind database. I'm using my locally hosted database, but I could also use the SQL Azure instance we connected to earlier. As you recall, you can access SQL Azure via many of the same data connection protocols as the on-premises version of SQL Server, like ADO.NET. WCF Data Services presumes an abstraction of the database into an object relational model, and the quickest way to get one of those is to use the entity framework. So here I'll create a new ADO.NET entity data model. The Entity Data Model Wizard allows you to create a model from scratch or reverse engineer an existing database, and I'll opt for the latter since I'm basing this service on Northwind. Next, I'll select the database objects I wish to expose via this data model, and eventually via the WCF data service. I'll make it simple here and just select all of the tables in the database. What results is the Entity Data Model Designer in Visual Studio, providing a schematic of the class structure that is generated to map to the underlying Northwind tables. Each table is, by default, represented by a class, with each column corresponding to a property in the respective classes, and primary foreign key relationships captured as navigation properties. At runtime, the entity framework keeps track of changes to the entities or objects and generates the appropriate SQL statements to update the underlying data storage based on changes to object instances in your application, essentially abstracting the nitty-gritty data access code and letting you focus on your higher-level business logic domain. There's a lot of power in the view here to adapt the classes and mappings to more appropriately model your domain and back-end data store. But for this simple demo, the default model will suffice. With the model created, the next step is adding the veneer, that instance of system.data.services.dataservice. And to do that, I add another new item to my project, a WCF data service. From here, it really doesn't get any easier. The item template generates a bit of boilerplate code, which requires only two changes to get this service up and running. First, I need to indicate in the to-do comment which data model this service is exposing. So here I'll plug in the Entity Framework Data Model class that I just generated. Next, notice there are a few lines of commented code in the body of initialize service. By default, the service is locked down, so if accessed from the outside, none of the data in the model will be exposed. Via the access rule methods you see here, you can open up specific entities within your model, ultimately tables and stored procedures within your database, for various levels of access. Since this is a demo, I'll be incredibly trusting and allow everyone to access all of the tables in my model. There are also other APIs available, including interceptors, that provide even more control on who can access the data in your model and what level of access they have to it, read, append, delete, and other variations. And that's it. I can now view the service in the browser. What you see here is a service document, a bit of XML that shows the entities that the service exposes. Using those entities, I can drill further into the model. For instance, here's my list of employees exposed as an ATOM feed. Each row is an entry and each column shows up as a property, complete with data type and value. Relationships between tables, say the territories covered by an employee, show up as links, all rather logical and all subscribing to REST, representational state transfer principles. There's even a query syntax you can use in the URL to filter data or drill into specific relationships. If I want the orders for employee 2, I can change the query to this. And if furthermore I only want those orders shipped to Sweden, I can add a filter. Again, all access occurs via simple and open protocols, HTTP and ATOM, or JSON via a simple change to the HTTP request headers. In code, you'd use the ADO.NET Data Services client versus explicit URLs and HTTP requests as an abstraction in a nearly identical fashion to the storage client code sample I showed earlier for accessing Azure Table Storage. Same open protocols, same programming layer, but significantly different underlying architectures. WCF data services provide a myriad of opportunities for data sharing, and in fact, the protocol that's used, the combination of the entity data model and Atom and JSON, have given rise to a new open specification sponsored by Microsoft called OpenData, or OData for short. OData promises to be the lingua franca of data exchange on the web, such that any producer of OData streams, such as Azure, but also including non-Microsoft sources like WebSphere and Netflix, can be read and manipulated by any consumer of OData, which is essentially any programming environment that supports HTTP and can handle XML data. This relatively simple and open concept has some great potential to foster data interoperability like never before. During this session, we've taken a tour of data options, ranging from the cloud to on-premises and everywhere in between. Each option has its own characteristics and sweet spots, which I've attempted to capture in this wrap-up slide. Obviously, there are a number of options out there with various pros and cons, so hopefully this session has provided some insight into sorting them out for you and giving you some resources to pursue further as you determine on what path your data will take you. Thanks for your time, and have a great rest of your day.